All right, and with that business accomplished, we will call our first case of the morning, which is number 083088, United States versus David Larson. Mr. Strang.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I rise primarily today to address the Commerce Clause. I, of course, can be redirected by the court, but it's the Commerce Clause that I want to discuss to the extent I have a chance here this morning. I want to discuss its application to a statute that punishes the local crime of violence of a defendant when that is committed in connection with causing the travel interstate of a particular type of victim. The defendant himself is not required to cross a state line or travel in interstate commerce as a matter of the statute's elements. Of course, I refer here to the interstate domestic violence count, that is count two of the indictment at issue. It's the victim who must travel in interstate commerce under the statute's terms, and what is punished is the crime of violence, and that's
the victim traveled in interstate commerce here, did she not?
Yes.
And in fact suffered significant physical deprivation while in transit, did she not?
No. I don't concede that she traveled in interstate commerce in the constitutional sense. I certainly concede, as I must, that she was carried across the state line from Wisconsin into Illinois.
How was she carried across the state line?
In a garbage can. The attack itself happened in Racine County, for all that appears. But
she traveled from one point in one state to one point in another state in a garbage can, deprived of some of her clothing, and the garbage can was packed with ice. Am I correct?
All of that is correct, and indeed, she had been beaten severely before being put in the garbage can. All of that is correct. In Wheeling, Illinois, I mean, the facts are, on this point, undisputed. She is stored in a storage locker. These are awful facts. I've lived with them for more than 5 years. I don't mean to evade or avoid them, but the issue here...
Well, suppose you tell us then how all of this amounts to not being, not transiting in interstate commerce.
She's carried in a private vehicle. We don't know by what route. And if there were a crossing state lines clause in the United States Constitution, or if simply crossing a state line always amounted to interstate commerce, then the government would have it here.
Do we have to overrule the Cametti case in order to come out your way?
You do not have to overrule Cametti. The Supreme Court...
You can't do that. That's why I ask. It's the Supreme Court.
Of course, Your Honor. Of course you can't do that, and I've nowhere asked you to do it. Stepping back from Cametti, which I want to address at some length, I think it's fair to say, taking the Supreme Court's cases as a whole, that never once has the United States Supreme Court upheld a federal law punishing local conduct, even when crossing of a state line is involved, unless at least one of three circumstances have been present. Either one, there was commercial activity or a commercial purpose. For example, say misbranding drugs, which can be punished federally, even though done locally and something that might fall within local police powers. There you have a commercial activity, a commercial purpose. Or two, there are cases in which the Supreme Court has upheld federal punishment of a local crime when there is a commercial item at issue. And the good example that comes to mind there, I think, is the federal felon in possession statute. the possession is purely local. This court and every other has found, every other court of appeals has found that the fact that the gun crosses a state line, and almost invariably in a commercial way, I mean, a gun is a commercial item in that sense, made in one state, transported into another, that permits congressional regulation under the Commerce Clause. Or three, at the far edge, and this really brings me to Caminiti, you can find Supreme Court cases upholding federal punishment of a local crime when a state line has been crossed if it's the defendant who has crossed the state line as a matter of the element of the statute, the Mann Act, at issue in Caminiti and Cleveland and Mortenson. The Mann Act regulated travel itself, and it was the defendant's travel, at least in part, that was an issue, is an issue in the Mann Act. Now, there may also be the travel of another purpose, a woman, for prostitution or some other immoral purpose, but the defendant himself is traveling. And to come back, Judge Ripple, to Caminiti now, it illustrates sort of how a principle which made sense in 1917 can lead us astray in 2009. Factually, in Caminiti, of course, what is involved is actual commercial transport, commercial travel. These are train tickets from Sacramento to Reno or from someplace in Oklahoma to Wichita, Kansas. This is ordinary commercial transport at issue factually in Caminiti. Even so, because the purpose of the trip in Caminiti was mere sort of debauchery, concubinage rather than commercialized vice, even so, in 1917, only 5 out of 8 voting members in Caminiti went along with that holding. Three of them, the other 3 members of the court, said no. This is not the purpose of the Mann Act, and indeed Caminiti primarily was a statutory construction case, as was Cleveland 29 years later. Although Caminiti does sort of eventually get to Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. And I thought Justice McKenna, who's not otherwise well remembered, had a nice line in describing here the fact that the travel across an interstate line may be an occasional convenience of immoral activity, but it is its accident, not its aid. And to me, that sort of captures a good deal about the Interstate Domestic Violence Act, at least as applied here and probably in any application. What we have here is a local crime of violence. I mean, that's the statutory term, crime of violence. And because Larson happens to live near the Illinois border and was an air traffic controller at an Illinois airport, what was then Palwaukee, and has a storage locker there, he crosses a state line.
So you don't see any more harm involved because there was an because they crossed the state line?
I don't see a federal harm involved, and I can't stretch this to be commercial.
The fact that it makes it far more difficult for law enforcement to work to coordinate because you've got to do it across the state line, I mean, makes no difference to you in terms of the federal interest. Is that right?
I'd have to think about the limiting case on that.
Doesn't the federal government have an interest in making sure that the channels of interstate commerce are not used in situations that are going to hamstring local law enforcement authorities from regulating things that they otherwise might be able to regulate a lot more expeditiously if it had happened in one state?
If we go back to Brooks, a 1925 Supreme Court case concerning car theft and moving stolen cars across state lines on ordinary roads, there's some support for that idea because the Brooks court was concerned about the difficulties of communication among states.
You don't have to go back that far. Footnote 5 in Morrison talks about this offense and distinguishes it from the civil action that was at issue under the Violence Against Women Act in Morrison.
Right.
And talks about the purposes. And doesn't pass judgment on the constitutional
right.
question, but intimates that this statute is different from civil remedy.
And I don't want to duck the question. I mean, we could posit a set of facts in which law enforcement efforts are hampered by the fact that, you know, you start in Tennessee and you end up in Alabama. We could posit facts like that. There's nothing here suggesting any of that. In fact, federal law enforcement wasn't involved until it was over. Local law enforcement handled this just fine. There's no...
Does it have to be?
Hmm?
Does it have to be?
I don't think it would necessarily have... the government doesn't have to prove that it was hampered. I'm simply saying here that as convenient as it might be to take a case to federal court because a state line was crossed, we've got to stay somehow anchored to the fact that this is a commerce clause. This concerns interstate commerce. And unless we are prepared to say that every private citizen's trip by any road or any means across a state line is equivalent for purposes of federal interest under the Commerce Clause to taking a common carrier for pay, unless we're prepared to go there, I think there's a problem with the statute. If this statute can stand, then it's also within the compass of the Commerce Clause for Congress to say, if you commit a battery and the victim retreats across a state line, you can be prosecuted in federal court.
Doesn't your argument call into question the constitutionality of the federal kidnapping statute, which is the other count in this case? I know you've made a factual attack on that, but
right. It
seems to me that if we were to accept your argument, we'd have to invalidate the federal kidnapping statute as well.
I don't think you do. A certain amount of my logic, if that's what it is, might carry you there, but I don't think you do. Invariably, I think, in the kidnapping statute, the defendant himself, because he's holding the victim, also is crossing a state line. So at least in this three-part framework into which I've sort of organized the Supreme Court cases, commercial activity or purpose, commercial item, or at least the defendant crossing a state line, I think the kidnapping statute fits at least there. I hasten to note that at least originally it looked as if Congress, with the kidnapping statute, acting after the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, at least initially it looked like Commerce had in mind a pecuniary motive or gain in saying, you know, for purpose of ransom or otherwise. Now, I want to be very clear. Very quickly, in Gooch and then later in Healy, the Supreme Court said ransom or any pecuniary gain need not be the necessary purpose of a federal kidnapping. The statute can apply to any other purpose as well. And indeed, I think this court quite permissibly and correctly has understood the Supreme Court to say that there's no purpose element that has to be proven in kidnapping at all. But kidnapping's a tougher case in terms of saying that it's altogether outside the scope of Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, both because the defendant, I think in every imaginable case, is traveling across the state line himself, and because you have this trace of a pecuniary motive involved in that statute. And again, I realize that the Supreme Court has watered that down to a non-necessity.
The presence of that hold element in the federal kidnapping statute.
I missed the first part of the question.
The presence of that hold element in the federal kidnapping statute undermines your multiplicity argument, it seems to me.
Well, Judge Rand is on your side, Your Honor, on that. I'm not. I don't know how I can force someone to cross a state line, force the intimate partner to cross a state line, without also holding them in the legal sense. Hold does not require a physical grasp, of course. Here, the indictment charged specifically force, coercion, or duress as the manner of causing the victim to travel, left out the verb fraud, even though the statute itself includes that. So as this was charged, the government convinced the grand jury and made its case on the theory that there was force, coercion, duress to cause this victim to cross a state line. That being the case, I don't know any way you could hold for kidnapping purposes without also forcing, coercing, or causing travel by duress. Indeed, I'm sorry.
That's a factual argument, not an elements argument, and for multiplicity.
The elements argument is this indictment was framed. It is, as this indictment was framed, it's an elements argument. What I was going to say is that the kidnapping itself here would qualify as the crime of violence that is committed in connection with causing the travel across state lines. And indeed, the Sixth Circuit in Page, which is the, you know, the 8-8 en banc split, considered that. You know, the defendant there was acquitted of the kidnap count, convicted on the interstate domestic violence count. And one of the objections the dissent had to the principal concurrence, maybe the only concurrence with the per curiam opinion, was you're sort of blowing past the fact that there was an acquittal on the kidnap. How can you say that the jury may nonetheless have found the kidnapping to be the crime of violence that the defendant committed? Kidnapping, of course, is a crime of violence. So, I think here, as a matter of the elements, kidnapping is included within interstate domestic violence. Now, I want to say something here about Hatchett, this court's decision in Hatchett. And this is a good example of why the three of you are there and I'm here, because I don't understand Hatchett. I really don't, in the end, understand Hatchett. It seems to say that under Dixon, we look only at elements, not at the means necessarily of committing the offense. It also seems to say that there is still room after Dixon, and there's an elaborate charting of the positions of the nine justices in Dixon. It seems to say that even though an offense, a greater offense, might be committed in other ways, it does not exclude the possibility that in a given case, the lesser is the same offense as the greater. And I think where Hatchett comes out is to say, look, you only get to look at this on a case-by-case basis when the greater offense itself requires proof of a crime.
That was the felony murder context, right?
Yes.
And that's a very special context for multiplicity challenges, isn't it?
Although Hatchett goes beyond that, also talks about CCE and conspiracy and says...
Well, that's where you've got... Well, maybe not in conspiracy, but in continuing criminal enterprise cases, RICO, et cetera, you've got predicate offenses that are necessarily nested within charged offense.
That's right. And the greater offense requires proof of a crime, I think is where Hatchett lands. Now, again, I've confessed I don't really understand Hatchett in the end. But if I'm reading it correctly, then here, understand the greater offense, interstate domestic violence, does require proof of a crime as one of its elements. So, you know, this one lies on an edge somewhere, and I'd be more comfortable trying to help if I understood Hatchett better.
But kidnapping wasn't the charged crime of violence that was committed in the interstate domestic violence charge. It was the beating, right?
I guess I'd have to go back and look closely at the indictment. I'm not sure the indictment limited itself there or made a specific election of the specific crime of violence. I just don't remember.
Let's assume that it did. Then the Hatchett problem isn't present.
It is a problem because as a matter of elements, the interstate domestic violence still requires proof of another crime. And that's what Hatchett seems to say. But again, I'm here, and the three of you are there for a reason. I'm also well into my rebuttal time.
Thank you. Ms. Jacobs.
May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors. Michelle Jacobs for the United States. As far as the Commerce Clause argument goes, I think that through your questions, you've sort of hit on what I wanted to say about it, and that is, in the end, I think that Mr. Strang's argument really is trying to set forth almost a new three-prong or three-category test for the Commerce Clause. He's talking about commercial purpose or activity, commercial items in commerce, like guns, but then his third one, as he indicated, was if the defendant crossed state lines, that perhaps that would in some way satisfy the Commerce Clause analysis. And that's just not the categories or the construct that the Supreme Court has set forth that this Court obviously is bound to apply. In its precedent and in the precedent of the circuits that have looked at this, the forcible transport or the transport of persons in the channels of commerce, in interstate commerce, Judge, as you indicated, has long been held to be within Congress's plenary power.
Is this the first post-Morrison challenge to this statute under the Commerce Clause?
I believe so, Judge. Without going back, I know that the sixth and fourth had looked at it pre-Morrison.
Post-Lopez.
I'm sorry, post-Lopez, yes.
Post-Lopez, but pre-Morrison.
Right. And then Langford and Glusman in the Second Circuit had looked at A1, but that is the defendant traveling in interstate commerce under the IDBA rather than the victim. But the cases have long recognized exactly, Judge Ripple, what you indicated, and that is that the prevention or spread of harm or evil to the other states or among the other states is a valid area for Congress under the Commerce Clause to regulate. And given that that's exactly what this statute does, I would submit that it is a valid channels or Category 1 statute. And for that reason, I would ask that this Court affirm Judge Randa's holding in that regard and join the other circuits that have so held. Now, with respect to the multiplicity question and whether or not kidnapping is a lesser included offense, the Supreme Court in Chatwin and others have defined this holding or held component or element of the kidnapping statute to imply unlawful restraint and also for some appreciable period, which obviously happened in this case, in that she was held for hours, actually overnight, in this garbage can. The indictment in this case did allege assault as the crime of violence, the predicate crime of violence for the IDVA, just in answer to your question. So when you look at the elements in the kidnapping statute, the victim has to be abducted or kidnapped and held, given the definitions and given the discussion in Chatwin about what hold means. I would submit that that is different than causing a victim to travel in interstate commerce by force. And I gave the example of the Ninth Circuit case, Dowd, where it wasn't at issue, but they didn't charge hold, or they didn't charge kidnapping, excuse me, because the victim was regularly allowed, I guess you would say, to meet with third parties. She was by herself in stores, in hotel rooms regularly. She wasn't being physically held, certainly, by the defendant. In this case, I could try to come up with hypotheticals where, if Mr. Larson had in some way threatened or used force with the victim initially, as he did, beat her or the like, and either ordered her or told her to move in interstate commerce, he didn't have to be present. Again, these are all factual hypotheticals, but the statute does not require him to hold or be in her presence in the transport and interstate commerce, as does the kidnapping statute. And so, again, I would submit that the district court got it right here, and that is that these really are two distinct and separate statutes. Judge Sykes, you were referencing the predicates, the felony murder, excuse me, and even in Dixon, some of the actual predicate offenses that are used in this analysis in Harris and in Dixon. And you're right that that is somewhat different than here, because the kidnapping itself was not charged as the predicate. Had we done that, I think it would be a different case. It would be a very different case. But what was charged was the assault as the predicate crime. And that assault, quite frankly, occurred not just in Wisconsin. I would submit, and I think it's important to recognize, the assault continued from the moment she walked in his house and got hit with the baseball bat through the being trapped in a garbage can filled with snow. In and of itself is a crime of violence. In and of itself is assault. When she tried to wave her hand out of the garbage can to get help from passing motorists, he assaulted her again. And trapping her in a public storage facility overnight in the bitter February cold, yet again, I mean, the assault continues. And so when you look at this factually, certainly, but also at the way that it was charged, the kidnapping is not a predicate, and it was not required that the government prove the kidnapping
assault. This is not a case where the act of violence is purely predicate to the interstate commerce.
Exactly.
It is part and parcel of the interstate commerce.
Absolutely.
So we need not really reach the question as to whether the statute covers a situation where the violence is purely a predicate to the interstate transportation. Am I right?
Right.
Could we talk a little about the other two points in the case?
Sure.
The sentence and the search. With respect to the search, mm-hmm. I'm concerned about why the authorities did not seek a warrant after they entered the house around noon. Afternoon. It seems they had time from between afternoon and 3 o'clock to get that warrant.
Okay.
And nobody did anything.
Well, I guess what I would say, Judge, is that while certainly between 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock, perhaps had they known what they knew by at least by 2 o'clock, I'm going to say, and I think the timeline is important there, had they known that at 11, perhaps they would have had time, although if they'd known that she was abducted and in danger and that it had happened likely at his home, it may have been exigent circumstances at 11 o'clock. But setting that aside, because that wasn't the case, at 11 o'clock, all they knew was that a 911 call had come in from in or around his home, and that there was a woman who was having trouble breathing or communicating with the dispatcher. By about 12:30, what they knew was that she was missing. Her husband said she had not come home. She had gone to his home to get the children. She had not come home, and that he had gotten some call about a tarp. You know, it was not entirely clear what had happened to her.
It's at this point that I become concerned as to why a warrant wasn't procured to search his home.
Well, I would submit, Judge, that at least the actions of law enforcement at about 2 o'clock tell you when they believed they knew there had been an abduction. And the reason that I say that is, yes, her husband was saying, I don't know what happened to her, she didn't come home. And they do go right back to the neighborhood and start canvassing the neighbors. But I think it's pretty clear they didn't recognize that for certain there had been an abduction and that these kids were missing yet. They didn't know what had happened for certain. But when that 911 call comes in at 2 o'clock in Milwaukee County, to the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department, and that's communicated back to the Racine County Sheriff's Department, at that point she is indicated, I'm in his truck, you know, covered with a tarp, I've been abducted. So I would submit that it's at 2 o'clock that it's important. And what do they do then? They do a teletype indicating take him into custody, detain him if you find him, and they issued the Amber Alert. So it's then that in law enforcement's mind, they know what's happened, they know what they're dealing with. I'm not sure that they would say that they knew with any degree of certainty what they were dealing with.
You folks keep telling us all you need for probable cause is reasonable certainty. I mean, I read your brief, I kept saying, she's going to be in here another day telling me this is enough to bust into a drug house.
Well, okay, I understand. I understand. And if you view that as probable cause and with enough reasonable certainty, perhaps they should have. Perhaps they should have. But
or
they were
at least
dealing
a telephonic warrant. That was the other question I had. There was no attempt to get in touch with a magistrate through a telephonic warrant during that period of time.
That's true.
Things they could have done.
Right. But I think that from the perspective of reasonable law enforcement and reacting to what was really such a fluid situation for them. You know, the information is kind of coming in from everywhere, from the husband, from this 911 call. They don't know what that is. They don't know where these kids are. But when they get that 911 call that she's been abducted, they know what they're dealing with, and they move forward with it. You know, that, and that's when they make the decision. Now, they make it carefully because, obviously, a crime of violence of some sort has happened. She's been abducted. But Judge, even if the entry was illegal, even if they should not have made entry without getting a telephonic warrant, for example, there are a couple of answers to your question. One is an inevitable discovery issue. Remember that they don't find her in any way based on what they find in that house or what they see in the house. Not at all. Right? By 2 o'clock, they've issued the teletype, detain him. And the way they find her is the next morning, they find those public storage cards in his wallet. They call the public storage facility, and the public storage facility employee hears her moaning. You know, and so is there any question, and I would submit that there's not, but that once she tells her story, what is law enforcement going to do if they had not made entry into his house? They are absolutely... there's just no question, at least in my mind, and I would say, you know, reasonable minds would not differ on this one. There is no question when they rescue her that they're going to get a search warrant for that house.
What did they find in the house during the period in question, when the legality of their presence in the house is in question?
In question. They find a large blood stain, I think, on the carpeting. They find a pair of pants that have duct tape on the bottom, some gloves, I believe, with human hair, things like that.
Tell me why you think this might be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, I mean, look at the rest of the evidence, which is what you have to do.
Right.
The victim testified that her ex-husband had done this to her, right, and in excruciating detail explained what had happened. The police found her in the defendant's storage, locked personal storage facility with all the rest of his stuff, including the baseball bat that she was beaten with. The 911 calls that are played. You know, that's the kind of evidence that, quite frankly, convicted this defendant. It wasn't some blood, a blood stain on his carpeting. Judge Randa, you know, I, again... looking at the evidence as a whole, is there any likelihood that without that blood stain, Judge Randa was not going to convict this defendant?
And this was a bench trial.
And this was a bench trial.
Could I move on
Absolutely.
To the sentence for a moment? One point. I appreciate some clarification on Ms. Jacobs. As I understand it, Judge Randa sentenced the defendant to life in prison because he believed that this episode had resulted in the miscarriage of her unborn child. Am I correct?
That's correct.
As I understand it, the defense makes the claim that there is little or no evidence of causality between this event and the miscarriage of the child. And points to the fact that there apparently was no hospital notation that she miscarried while in the hospital. And that's the point I'd like you to speak to, if you would. What is the evidence of causality, and why isn't there any hospital recordation of that?
Well, I can't speak to why the hospital did or did not put particular information in the hospital records that Mr. Strang had in his possession. I don't know. I don't know. But what I can tell you is that from the time of the written verdict, there was no question but that Judge Randa had found in the verdict that she was pregnant and that she had miscarried 2 days after the assault. There's also evidence in the form of trial evidence and in the verdict that she was suffering renal failure by the time they found her, that she was within, and I don't think this was disputed, within about an hour of death at the time that she was found. And so I would submit that while it was not medical testimony or evidence, because none of that was put in at the trial, but that there was sufficient evidence that Judge Randa could draw the inference that given the timing and given the extreme abuse that this pregnant woman had undergone in just 2 days before, that the miscarriage, again, that the inference was there and could be supported, that the miscarriage was the result of this brutal assault. I would be happy to answer any other questions that the court may have.
Why wasn't the 20-year offense found at sentencing based on the verdict findings?
I don't know. I mean, that's the real honest answer to your question. When I began writing this brief, I began writing it as if it was a 20-year offense, because given the findings, I mean, obviously given the evidence, I assumed, and actually in writing the brief, I think the defense assumed that it was a 20-year case, and I just, in going back over the judgment, caught it. So I honestly do not know the answer to your question, Judge. I'm sorry. Any other questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Strang, how much time? You've got 1 minute.
Your Honor, you were correct, and as is my friend Michelle Jacobs, the indictment alleges an assault causing serious bodily injury. If her argument that the assault continued just by the fact that Ms. Jendusen Nikolai was locked in the garbage can in the storage locker, if that argument were correct, it would prove too much, because at that point you couldn't get away from the overlap with the holding element of kidnapping. You simply couldn't. The underlying crime of violence here would be indistinguishable from the holding if it were true. Now, I think factually it's incorrect to say that because someone is injured in a battery or an assault or beating, and their condition continues to deteriorate because they aren't treated, they're denied medical care, that that's an ongoing assault. I think that stretches the term a bit too far. But if it were true, as I say, I think you'd be into the overlap with holding. I want to say finally that my time is up. I didn't suggest a new three-part test. The categories I'm suggesting are my effort simply to assemble and make some sense of the body of Supreme Court cases in the area of the Commerce Clause. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Strang, you were appointed for Mr. Larson, is that right?
Yeah, 5 years ago plus.
You have the thanks of the court for your service to your client and the court. Our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.